former President Trump indicted. The gender-affirming care ban for minors heads to the governor, plus a major change to the non-compliant prosecutor bill, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending March 31st, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Donald Trump became the first former president in U.S. history to be charged with a crime as a Manhattan grand jury indicted the controversial political leader. The charges relate to payments made during Trump's 2016 presidential campaign to cover up claims of an extramarital affair. In a statement, Trump called the indictment political persecution, election interference, and a witch hunt. As the former president runs for re-election, he also potentially faces legal troubles related to attempts to interfere in the vote count in Georgia's 2020 election and storage of classified documents at his home in Florida. Does this indictment deliver re-election for Donald Trump? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Mike O'Brien. John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, does this embolden Trump supporters enough to deliver re-election?
Oh, I think it may embolden Trump supporters enough to give him the nomination. I don't think it's enough to get him the election, no. I mean, the idea that, you know, a former president is immune from prosecution no matter what he does, either in office or afterwards, is crazy. I mean, he's the one who said that if he shot somebody on Madison Avenue, he'd still get the nomination.
Fifth Avenue,
that's right. I'm sorry. Street over. Okay.
And you're from New York. You should know that.
I'm not from Manhattan. But anyway, he said that that it wouldn't stop his supporters from supporting him. And we're going to have proof of that pudding pretty soon. I think some of his supporters have drunk the Kool-Aid. A lot of the supporters have drunk the Kool-Aid. And I don't think it probably makes him a martyr in their eyes. They don't care that he breaks the law. They don't care what he does, because he's their hero, no matter how bad he is.
Does this deliver re-election for Donald Trump?
I agree with that. It doesn't deliver re-election. I'm not sure it even delivers the nomination. I think what we saw in the polling prior to this, DeSantis is kind of up and down, closes the margin, and it opens back up based on whatever circumstances. But Trump was softening. You know, that was clear. There is a part of the base. This didn't embolden the base of Trump supporters. The base was emboldened. Mm. They were emboldened coming out of, I mean, January 6th tested that, and it tested that with a segment of Trump's voting base that under no circumstances are they leaving him. So let's just add this to the pile of the rest of that. I think there was an establishing and growing constituency of people that, you know, and I'd include myself in this, where I look at Trump and go, we cannot do that again. That was chaos. You know, whatever you think of it, whatever you think of the policies and the decisions that were, you know, the good things that came out of that administration, the overarching chaos was almost not worth it. On one hand. On the other hand, you go, come on. The real criminal issues that he's got are being on the phone with the Republican Secretary of State of Georgia trying to overturn the election, right? That's a problem.
Or January 6th. Yeah.
That's Nixonian, yeah. Right? This you look at and go, come on, can we get, I mean, no one doesn't think he did it. That's the other thing, right? If George W. Bush did this, we'd be shocked. We're not at all surprised by this. But it's not delivering an election. It's not delivering a nomination. It's just adding to another list of things that people that were unwilling to be dissuaded at all, believe.
To that point, there's a lot that can happen between now and when people are casting ballots with this indictment.
Including more indictments
elsewhere. But in that sense, how much will this affect his chances one way or the other?
Well, I agree with what has been said thus far. This, if anything, probably puts him leaps and bounds ahead of everyone else, certainly in the party, including Ron DeSantis and others, in terms of securing the nomination. Again, I think you have more than 50% of likely voters who would under no circumstances ever cast a vote for Donald Trump. So I think he's dead in the water. If he gets the nomination, that's as far as it goes, which would be certainly detrimental, I presume, to Republicans who would like to regain the White House. So I think that's lurking. So a couple other things here. The danger I see in all this is this attack that we've seen before on the notion of our institutions and our democracy and our judiciary. You know, you can only take a hammer and club away at the notion of an independent judiciary and a notion of a rule of law, a nation of laws, and this now quaint concept, apparently, that people adhere to that, even if they're at the highest levels of government. And so that worries me. Again, that's sort of just another brick out of that wall. And the other caution, you know, these indictments, they are on, I guess, in the scheme of things, minor. But you can also frame it as the actions that allegedly precipitated the indictment delivered him the election, because it was coming on the heels of the Billy Bush interview where a lot of people were saying a would-be president can't say that about women. And then in the week that followed, this revelation of Stormy Daniels' affair would have come out. So you could argue, and again, that's not a court of law, but in a larger justice sense,
that it's over. It's time.
That it effectively his conduct, alleged conduct, delivered him the presidency.
I was going to ask, are you surprised at the seemingly knee-jerk reactions to say this is not, you know, this is invalid or it's political persecution and all that? I was going to ask, are you surprised? That's a silly question. Of course you're not surprised. But Mike just brought up the idea of the Georgia issue with him potentially trying to influence the vote count there. If the indictment had been about that, is the reaction the same?
I don't think. No, I do think so. I mean, no one seems to care. No one's read these indictments. They're all sealed. Yeah. But and to be fair, there aren't any denials. Like, not even from Donald Trump, right? There are no denials that he did or didn't do it. It's all about weaponizing, you know, prosecution. And, you know, I would say the reason it's the first, I guess, indictment against a president is because maybe the other ones, I don't know, didn't have 9 or 10 different investigations going into them at once.
Yeah,
One or two of them are bound to bear fruit.
This goes back years.
It feeds into the culture of where we're at as a political system right now, though. I mean, think about how few impeachments we've had over the course of history and how frequent we've had them or calls for them over the last 2 decades by both parties, right? It's the automatic. We're impeaching Biden like the day after he gets. We're impeaching Trump the day after he gets elected. You know, and it depends who brings it in this environment. If the Georgia recount, you know, Nixon got brought down because the Republicans took him down. It wasn't because the Democrats brought him down. So you have a Democrat DA bringing this against Trump, and it's just too easy in this environment to go, yeah, it's political, and everyone just goes, yeah, it's political.
Yeah, well, tell that to Edwards, who faced the same thing, but this was much worse because he was paying it off while he was president.
But so, if you don't have a Republican constituency within the policymaking establishment or the enforcement establishment, what other recourse is there than for Democrats to arguably fulfill their obligations?
But that's what the reaction is going to be.
Well, let's see what the special prosecutor does with January 6th, too, because I think that's a potential for indictment for him as well.
All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question, and this week's question is, will the indictment of former President Donald Trump help his reelection bid? A, yes, or B, no? Fascinated by the results of that one. Last week's question, we asked you if you think the Indiana General Assembly is doing enough to address rising utility bills. Less fascinated by the results of this one. 10% say yes, 90% of you say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. House Republicans voted this week to ban medicinal and surgical gender-affirming care for transgender youth. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports the bill now goes to the desk of Governor Eric Holcomb.
The bill would ban medicinal gender-affirming care, like hormone therapy and puberty blockers, and gender-affirming surgeries, which aren't performed on minors in Indiana. The bill's House sponsor argued the legislature had an obligation to protect children from these procedures. Democratic Representative Blake Johnson called the General Assembly's view of identity myopic.
We tell them that if they're true to themselves, they don't belong in Indiana.
Two Republicans joined Democrats in voting against it. Governor Holcomb has previously vetoed anti-trans legislation. He told reporters last week parents not only had a right to their children's health and well-being, but in fact have the responsibility of it. The General Assembly has overturned 7 of Holcomb's vetoes since he took office in 2017.
Mike O'Brien, very weak veto in Indiana. All you need is a majority in each house, and the only way a bill gets to the desk of the governor is with a majority in each house. So, does it really matter whether Eric Holcomb signs the bill?
As a procedural matter, no. I mean, for that, you know, for that exact reason, I think he's shown a willingness to try to be more of a centrist on these issues. This one's hard. I mean, this one's interesting because it's a bill trying to get ahead of things that aren't currently happening in Indiana. It's a problem in search of
there are things that are absolutely happening that people are saying are saving kids' lives, yeah, and that would be banned.
Sure.
If this were banned,
There's other things in this bill.
I think you would have had huge votes even from Democrats.
Absolutely.
So in one sense, it's a solution in search of the problem. In another sense, you know, in defense of the legislature, the Republican part of the legislature, if you allow the surgery part, if you're trying to put that back in the box after it starts happening, for whatever reason, as this evolves, yeah, and you know the scientific understanding of this evolves, the treatment for this evolves. And those, you know, more of those treatments come online in places like Indiana. The legislature reacting to that is far more damaging, I think, in that circumstance. So I think they're trying to get ahead of this before it's here. But we'll see what the governor does. He's obviously shown a willingness and he's in a second term. So what does he care? He's already picked this fight, and I think he's probably willing to pick it again.
Does it matter whether or not he vetoes it?
Oh, I think it does. I think it sends at least partially a message that Indiana isn't full of bullies that are intolerant of people that aren't like them. I think having him veto it, even if it gets overridden, sends a better message to the public than having this adopted by the legislature. Because, you know, the surgeries aren't occurring and they're not going to be occurring. And on top of that, any of the treatments going on already have parental consent. And they're the Republicans who are screaming that we need more parental involvement in everything. Well, the parents have agreed with the child that this is necessary. And no, the legislature is going to substitute its judgment and its morality for that of the parent. And it is a perfect example of the Republican Party supermajority beating up on more vulnerable parts of our community. And it's shameful.
I believe Eric Holcomb thinks about policy when he's deciding whether or not to veto anything. I don't know that he thinks about the politics, but he's a politician, so let's assume he does. For him, he's in his second term. He can't run for re-election. It doesn't look like there's something else to run for, at least right now, unless he decides to challenge Jim Banks, which seems unlikely. What are the political calculations for Eric Holcomb on this?
I mean, not much. I mean, he doesn't really have anything to lose. Yeah. A bunch of people already didn't like when he vetoed the transgender sports bill from last year, youth sports bill. So this would be pretty similar to that. And I think he could...
Only affecting many more people.
Correct, exactly.
I think there was basically one kid in Indiana, yeah, affected by the bill last year.
So it doesn't hurt him to do it at all. And he can make a good reason why. I mean, the most interesting part about this whole discussion in the bill is we keep hearing these unproven, irreversible treatments. These are treatments, hormone therapy and puberty blockers, have been given for decades and decades for other reasons, other diagnoses. They don't have a problem with the treatment. They have a problem with why you want them.
Yeah. And so I'll ask you for the prediction then.
I thought before this panel discussion that he would have signed it, but based on the brain trust giving us perhaps a glimpse
absolutely
behind
not.
The...
Absolutely. Do not represent that.
All right. Well,
I don't know.
There's a great study unfolding below our borders. If you go across Ohio, or the Ohio River, I should say, in Kentucky, which just their General Assembly just passed virtually the same law.
Yeah.
Andy Beshear, the Democratic governor, vetoed it. Well, guess what happened the very next day? The similar situation. You only need 50% plus one, simple majority, overrode that veto, plus 14 other bills, all in one day. Yeah. Now, talk about slam dance. But then you talk about the policy discussion, but strangely enough, this is all happening as Andy Beshear is announcing he is seeking a second term, and the polls show he's ahead. So
he's also a Democrat.
My point is, if he still retains popularity and has vetoed a bill that Republican supermajorities, I mean, it is like the twin, separated at birth scenario here, minus the Democratic governor. So it is interesting to see
Kentucky's
this play out.
It's still the South, though. It's still the old South politically.
Yeah.
You know, Indiana flipped.
Yeah, but my point is, you would think that he would lose
the election. Like, he didn't, like, Yeah. It's not remarkable for Kentucky to elect a Democrat governor.
Yeah. All right. An Indiana Senate bill aimed at so-called non-compliant prosecutors underwent a complete overhaul before a House committee advanced the legislation this week.
The bill originally targeted prosecutors who refused to prosecute certain crimes. But after changes in committee, the measure now creates a prosecutor review board composed of local prosecutors that would decide if a new special prosecutor's unit under the Indiana Prosecuting Attorney Council would handle cases for any reason that the board finds necessary. IPAC's Courtney Curtis says her organization has historically been opposed to previous noncompliant prosecutor bills, but supports this version because it gives other prosecutors the power to determine if that special prosecutor unit should step in.
We take an oath to fairly execute the laws of the state of Indiana, and so if this bill would pass, we would fairly execute that law as well.
The bill is now headed to the House Ways and Means Committee.
John Schwanes, are prosecutors really going to go after fellow prosecutors?
I doubt it. I think they will give a lot of deference to their elected colleagues. And there is already a mechanism for, quote unquote, punishing elected prosecutors who it's called election. And it's always at least for, you know, no more than 4 years away, in all likelihood less than that. The other question I would have somewhat facetiously is, good thing for backers of this bill, it's a state statute. It doesn't have any overreach beyond the border or any scope in, say, New York, because what would happen to a district attorney in the state of New York that was aware of a crime and didn't prosecute it, like, say, whatever Donald Trump is accused of having done? These things, as I've said before, always have a way of cutting in a direction you don't expect. And we laugh about it now, but there will be that kind of Trump scenario, minus Donald Trump, in the next decade where this tests the theory that, but the politics, of course, will be flipped on their head.
So the Senate has been, and folks like Aaron Freeman in the Senate have been very keen to go after so-called non-compliant prosecutors for years, and the House has been uninterested in that. So this is the House's version of doing something without targeting specifically a non-compliant prosecutor. But here's the thing that gets me about this policy. There's no guidelines for what this policy review or this board could consider. What do we think is going to happen?
I don't know. Like, can I just send them a complaint about
yes.
What I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, you just
that seems to be the new
he
method.
He was mean.
They're
going to
be busy.
She was mean to me.
They're going to be busy because if they get even half of the letters that journalists get from people who have been screwed over by prosecutors, they're going to be inundated. But here's the deal. I'm good with it because I'm tired of hearing about non-compliant prosecutors. It's been going on for years. Let's move on.
Go. Wait, as a former prosecutor, I can tell you, you get people that are so emotionally involved that they don't care what the elements of a crime are. They think they ought to be charged anyway. And as a prosecutor, you know the elements are missing or you know you can't make the case. They don't want to hear that. And that's what they're going to get is inundated by people like that who are not satisfied that the prosecutor's following the law and the evidence. That's nuts.
Well, you want charges filed until you don't want charges filed.
Georgia.
That's Georgia. Can they get complaints the other way, too? Yeah.
I see no reason.
That's
why.
That charge shouldn't
have
been filed?
Yeah,
I see no
reason why not. There is nothing in the bill preventing that. Anyone can make a complaint for, it would appear, any single reason.
So forward all your letters.
Yeah, now you have a place, something to do with them. That's good.
Are you surprised at all? So the Indiana Prosecuting Attorneys Council has been against the noncompliant prosecutor bill since it was first filed. Are you surprised they're going along with this?
As a matter of, like, legislative inertia, yeah, because it still stays in their kind of under their purview, really, as a profession, right, and as a group, and that's a pretty tight-knit group of people that, regardless of party,
which is another reason why I don't see them attacking each other in this way. Unless there's something that's very obviously like misconduct or something like that, but there are already
there's already a process in place.
That special prosecutor, mechanism already exists in these scenarios. If a county prosecutor says, "Look, I can't do this for whatever reason or don't want to,"
right.
But I suppose
I'm sending it next door.
If you're IPAC, this is the first time the House even agreed to take up this bill, whether or not this was going to be the outcome or not. There was more momentum for this issue than there had ever been.
Because it took away the issue of non-compliant prosecutors.
Well, but I mean,
variations of this have been, we'll give it to the Attorney General.
Right, which they actually
absolutely
took.
Not,
right.
Now,
oh, no.
This bill now takes more power away from the Attorney General because it takes away some
which
of
adds to its popularity.
Concurrent jurisdiction. Yeah. I say.
But we have a lot of different versions of this, and so for IPAC to jump on this in a way that can control as an industry, I don't think
it's the same thing that Nikki says. Yeah. I mean, it takes. This is something that's going to dog them, regardless of if this dies this session.
They're already getting dogged.
Yeah, well, they're going to be dogged anyway. But this at least has been there, done that. We've taken care of that.
So here's my last question, and I'll ask you this, Mike. Let's say this becomes law. It's in place for a couple years. If Ryan Mears continues to be the prosecutor of Marion County and continues not to prosecute certain cases, as he has said he doesn't want to do, Republicans clearly aren't happy about that, or at least some. If this board doesn't do anything, do lawmakers come back and go, well, we tried this method, but we're going to have to do something else?
It doesn't work, sure. Just like literally every other issue.
But it's hard.
It's compromised
hard. Except daylight savings.
It doesn't do everything that the legislature expected it to do. They're always back. That's why they come back every year.
Yeah. It's too bad.
A Senate committee added a wrinkle to a housing infrastructure loan fund measure this week before sending it to the full Senate. The underlying bill would allow local governments to apply for money to help pay for infrastructure costs for new housing, such as streets, sidewalks, and utility lines, while the additional language has to do with residential TIFs.
Tax dollars generated in a TIF district are diverted and typically used to pay for the infrastructure costs in that geographic area. Under current law, residential TIFs can only be used in areas with low new housing growth, and they must be approved by school boards in districts affected by the TIF. The language added to the housing infrastructure bill would remove those guardrails. Ryan Hoff, Association of Indiana County's Director of Government Relations, cautioned lawmakers about doing so.
New homes means new residents who require services, including constitutional level services like courts, jails, and elections. Under residential TIF, any increment that would help to pay for those services is diverted to development costs.
Hoff suggested that if lawmakers remove the current guardrails for residential TIFs, they should add a county-level approval mechanism that helps ensure another set of eyes on whether it's the appropriate policy. But Jenna Bentley, Accelerate Indiana Municipalities Government Affairs Director, said the shackles need to come off residential TIFs. She pointed to a local community, Covington, Indiana, that needs such help.
But the local school board won't approve it unless they give them $1 million for football fields or lighting.
The language added by the Senate committee this week comes from a separate Senate bill, which has not advanced in the House.
Yeah. Nikki Kelly, let's talk about process first. Senate has a bill they clearly like. House doesn't, at this point, seem interested in it. So the Senate says, all right, we'll just put it into one of your bills, one of your priority bills. Is that above board?
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's be honest. They do that all the time. Yeah. And I think it is fair. It's passed one chamber. It's, you know, should be allowed to be considered and both sides to it. That I don't have any problem with. I just get a little confused on the residential TIF stuff because I feel like we've got a little, like, I don't know, psychoticness going. Like, half the time I hear we're worried about TIF and it's being used too much and we need to clamp down on it. And the other half of the time, it's like we need to, like, loosen it up and let everyone do it. And
I mean, this session, it seems like that half of the time is when it's in the Senate half, they're fine with expanding TIFs. And when it's in the House half, they're not, even though that bill didn't ultimately go through. This is really, I mean, I don't think there are a lot of issues in which the Indiana Association of Counties and what used to be the Indiana Association of Cities and Towns and is now AIM, they're not usually at opposite ends of an issue here. Is that show you how complicated this is?
It is complicated. And, you know, it's a reminder to Nikki's point that you can't look for consistency in the General Assembly or probably, for that matter, any legislative body. Because as much as people want to portray these issues as broad, philosophical, you know, clear-cut issues of this is what's right for the best governance and this is what's best for a local, you know, government of the people, closest to the people, it always, always comes down to sort of these nuances. But what does this mean for my core constituencies and for the groups that have been most supportive to me? So nothing, the branch never cuts, breaks clean.
For a legislature, or at least some in the legislature, who have been concerned about how many school referendums there are and been trying to rein that in, isn't a surefire way to guarantee more school referendums is to give schools less power to say, no, don't take away some of our tax dollars?
Well, not only that, but like have no say in how the community's growing either, you know, and how those dollars are being spent and the burden that that's going to put That development, you know, as these developments come online, the burden that puts on, the strain that puts on the district,
right.
You know, and having open
yeah,
up and taking them out of that kind of
this is about housing. It's solely right. about we want more people to live in this community, and then we are going to give the community less tax dollars in order to accommodate those more people.
Well, the state budget
that's
may have that same effect anyway. So,
that's why the TIF idea is a bad idea. I mean, the local government should provide the infrastructure. They have the ability to borrow to do that. They can regroup it with the taxes, property taxes, over time. And that doesn't put the same kind of burden on local school districts or local law enforcement. The idea of a TIF for this is nuts. I mean, it ought to be done the other way. And we need low-cost housing. We need housing. I mean, how many studies have we had that said people can't afford to live in Indiana? So it's necessary to do, but it ought to be done by local government, not the TIF where the money goes someplace else, puts the burden on schools and law enforcement. I don't know why they complicated it. Somebody's making money off it is the only thing I can think of.
That's Indiana
Builders.
Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at WFYI.org/IWIR or on the PBS video app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.